Hi, I'm Gareth Armstrong, and a few weeks ago, I was privileged to share a stage with some really smart people. We were participating in the first Next Gen Masterclass held at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. The audience, which was filled with business leaders and entrepreneurs, were there to hear our perspectives on the current realities being faced by entrepreneurs and SMEs in South Africa. The discussion begins with each of us sharing our perspectives. The panel consisted of a COO, an economist, a funding veteran, and myself. Then became an on-stage discussion, followed by an audience-led Q&A. As many of you will know, I like to be a little irreverent, and I wanted to come at it from some slightly under-discussed angles. I also wanted us to talk about the real issues and not just the same old, you know, the stuff that we've all heard before. Being last to share that initial perspective, I was delighted to be beaten to this irreverent punch. It was a worthwhile discussion, and I particularly enjoyed the Q&A section. Here it is. Enjoy.
I'd like to introduce our topic for today. So each masterclass will focus on a particular topic for discussion. Our topic today is the current economic climate in South Africa and how it affects small businesses or any businesses and other burning platforms. So I think we've got just the right people here to speak on that topic. Thank you for joining us. Okay, so for all of you, and I think we'll just go down the panel, what's happening? What's the current economic status right now in South Africa, and how does it affect small businesses?
Good morning, everyone. It's a very difficult question because I'm sitting next to an economist, so I just need to make sure that I say the right things. But I think we all know they say economists never agree, so yeah, it's fine. From our perspective as Black Umbrellas is that over the past number of years, the economy has been very stagnant and with very minimal growth. I think last year GDP growth was 0.8%, and this year it's forecasted to be around 1.2%. And that, compared to our peers in the rest of the continent, is very, very slow growth. And it's extremely worrying because in that environment, big business doesn't do great, doesn't do well. And then if big business is struggling, what about small business? Business is going to struggle even more, especially in taking into account, I think, a lot of our small businesses in South Africa do business to business. They do B2B rather than doing B2C. They depend on work that they get from corporates, from government. And if things are slowing down economically at a macro level, then it's going to be a challenge when you then go down at a micro level where there'll be less business that small business gets out there and therefore might then lead to some of them closing down their businesses. And I think we've seen over the past number of years the rate of liquidations has actually gone up. But I think it's slowed down a bit, but it's still very high historically compared to previous periods, which tells you that a lot of small businesses are struggling and closing down. And if big corporates like Marion Roberts as well are potentially going to voluntary liquidation, that sets the scene for the challenges that we face economically as a country. And where I'm sitting right now is just to see what transpires after the elections, because I guess from that perspective, we'll have a clearer picture as to where economically the country or the plans are or the country is going to go. Because I think a lot of people right now might be sitting on investments and waiting for the elections to come and pass before they make investment decisions in the country and move forward.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Dumisa, your thoughts?
I think to add on to Emmanuel's point, at a global level, there are a number of megatrends and shifts that are taking place that influence the domestic investment and business landscape. And one of those is, of course, the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China. And the slowing down of growth of the Chinese economy and the U.S., they are particularly important because they are the top four trading partners for South Africa, both on the export and import side. But one area of discussion that does not necessarily always receive particular attention is the question of demography in these particular economies. Lots of reports were written that by 2030, 2050, China would be the biggest economy in the world. It would surpass the U.S. But there have been revisions with regards to that specific, to those specific forecasts, particularly because of the question of demography. These are highly sophisticated economies that are in a developed context, and they have aging populations, as it were, where in the U.S. from the 70s, they had a population growth rate of around 2.5. The next 10 years, it's going to go down to about 0.5. With China, it's in the negatives, primarily because 30 years ago, they had a one-family, one-child policy rule, and they're trying to change that. But it's now difficult to change that kind of family structure that it has now set in, where young people have grown as single children in a household. Now, when you're telling them, okay, guys, please start having more babies, we need more people to work for our economy, it's a bit like, no, I'm actually focusing on my studies and my career and so on and so forth. So that is a productivity challenge that those two economies face. And as a result, we don't see China surpassing the U.S. in the next 30 years to come because of that particular question. The Eurozone question as well is a significant contributor, particularly because of the relationship that South Africa has with the European Union and Britain in particular. There are a number of manufacturers and agricultural producers that export to that particular market that has had a significant impact to local producers in South Africa as well. But also recent developments with what's happening with oil-producing nations, particularly with the price of international crude oil prices, where last year South Africans as consumers, we were hit with a number of petrol price increases, as we did about 2 weeks ago. And that was primarily because of increasing international crude oil prices that were informed by OPEC nations foreseeing an oil glut, so too much excess oil in the market. But the global economy is not growing, so people are not consuming as much of this particular commodity as they would if we had a robust economy globally. And so because of that, they've cut down the supply of oil. And of course, that does not always augur well with the South African economy when oil prices go up. And we, South Africa being an important emerging market with the most traded emerging market currency, we are highly exposed to fluctuations in terms of portfolio flows. So whether it's something that we do domestically with changing of finance ministers or whatever the case may be, we receive a knock there. But if Turkey, for instance, does funny things with their money supply, with their central bank, we're also affected there, because when people are selling emerging market currencies, they sell the rand. And so then you see, but I mean, we have been on good behavior in the recent 2 weeks, but why are we at 14.50, 14.60 and still climbing? It's because we're highly exposed to those international markets. And then we see the input costs in terms of the price of petrol and informing inflation. And so in the medium term, that's where the story, in my view, would become a bit better, because like Emmanuel's just mentioned, elections would have passed, we would be clear around particular policy questions in South Africa, whether it be the land question or in the mining sector. There are some regulations that the Competition Commission is instituting with regards to small businesses and other bigger players, and making the level field more equitable as well. So from an investment perspective, from a business person who wants to invest the South African economy, the horizon over the 5 years may be slightly more promising, depending, of course, on what happens post the elections.
Thank you. Thank you, Ndumiso. Warren, over to you.
So I have a paradoxical view. On the one hand, to summarize what I think we all know and what you guys have said, we're in proper cuck, globally and locally. We know that, right? That's just the headline. They're smarter than me to give all the details about that. But the way the paradoxical view comes in is, and we're slightly biased because we're dealing with SMEs ourselves all the time, and so it's affecting them in a paradoxical way, positive and negative. Those that can't adapt and are not alert and are not strategic about their business model and what's happening are the ones that are liquidating, dying, and when they apply for us for funding, those are the ones we are not funding. Sometimes we get it wrong, but mostly we're not funding those. But on the other hand, it's exciting to see, despite all of that, an entrepreneurial spirit is people always adapt and shift and pivot and make a plan. And you've got a lot of that happening, and we're funding a lot of those businesses that are expanding despite all of this, because they have no choice. An entrepreneurial DNA, whether the economy is growing or suppressing, they're going to operate at the same 9 of the Richter scale on the rev counter all the time. The difference is, in a more difficult environment, it's the smarter, tougher, those that are able to learn a bit more that will adapt. So we are seeing those types of things happening. It's not enough, but we are seeing those types of things happening. So that has implications for us and you guys as entrepreneurs. How do we adapt in such a cuck environment?
Thank you, Kumaran. Gareth, over to you.
If I can just take a moment, I'm a little bit more irreverent. My background is to be iconoclastic in a fashion sometimes. And so please, if suddenly you feel like you need to shout out or throw something, just do that. Let's turn this into a...
Just aim at that side.
Yeah. But let's turn this into something quite dynamic. I think that we've got a real opportunity.
Have a
conversation. We've got some brains in the room. I'm always semi-embarrassed when I hear my bio read, because I'm not very smart, but I get to mix with smart people. And today's similar. Nondumiso gave me a little bit of a segue into my initial comment when he introduced China and how they imposed something on their population to reduce the amount of people that were being produced. And that's where I want to come in with South Africa. And so I'll tell a very quick story and then I'll just give you the rest of my view as an initial intro. And the other day, I'm lucky I get to speak to experts on an ongoing basis and thought leaders. I was called up by someone that I'd invited to be part of a piece of content that we were creating. And he is a very high-level, well-respected economist, and I won't say anything else too much more about his details. He holds a very senior position in a very big organization that we would all know. And he said to me, "Gareth, I'm sorry." I said, "Sorry, what do you mean you're sorry? You don't have to apologize to me. Why are you apologizing to me?" He said, "Gareth, I'm sorry, I can't come and talk to you." I said, "You can't come and talk to me, what do you..." And then he went on to explain that his job was on the line because he was making statements that politically weren't correct. And so my addition to this conversation here is that maybe like in China, in South Africa, our politics and economics are so close, they touch all the time, that we sometimes find ourselves, and you said paradox, there's a paradox that goes on, it's probably a better way to say it, I say we're schizophrenic. In academic environment, they say we're in a fractured economy. What really that means is we talk about our politics are socialist in nature. But we try and run our businesses and our economy as a capitalist state. And how do those things work together? Well, the Nordic states have helped us see that there are opportunities there, but that really comes with very competent leadership, a high level of accountability and responsibility. And in South Africa, we don't have that. And all of that then trickles down into the market, into the way that we are interacting and the way that we respond. And I mean, we need foreign direct investment, but we can't because we've got someone standing up and firing ministers and doing all sorts of crazy stuff, and then the rest of us are impacted in a particular kind of way. So I just wanted to actually just use the word schizophrenic and as my position for where we're at. Yeah, schizophrenic is what I'll hold as my position until someone can produce evidence or otherwise.
Thanks, Gareth. You've kind of answered my next question for you, which is aimed at you. And just to say that you've been exposed to a lot of thought leaders and, you know, you work with people who are in the know and close to these issues. What would you say are red flags at the moment for small businesses?
Well, there's a number, and I know we're going to talk about technology and the fourth industrial revolution, all of that a little bit later, so I won't go there. The biggest concern is where are we going to be from a governance perspective in 3-5 years? We're speaking about holding off for the election to come to pass, but without doubt we're going to see the ANC leading the country again. And this is not a political debate, although we can get political if we're interested. But undoubtedly we're going to see the ANC leading the country. But then what does that translate into? And at the heart of the ANC, and this is a big concern for me, is the NDR. And at the heart of the NDR is socialism. While I believe that there are elements of socialism that are very important, I don't believe socialism is an answer. I believe capitalism is an answer in our environment. And so add then to that, we pour all of this into the crucible, add into that an Insta style or Insta approach to everything. We all want to be everywhere very quickly. I was lucky to be part of a team mentoring a young man a few days ago in a competition where he was going to be able to, you know, stood a chance of getting his hands on 10 million rand. And he didn't get into the top five. There were 15 of them, didn't get into the top five. And then he had an offer from someone else because they thought he had a great idea. And I said, just hold on, just relax. But he just went, and I think he's going to get himself into a bit of a funny situation now. But it's Insta everything. And then there's one other thing that I'd like to add to Insta, and that is a true blue lack of understanding. We call ourselves entrepreneurs. We don't know what the hell that means. It's the truth. I started a non-profit 5 years ago called Future CEOs, and part of that was because I had gone out, I did some volunteering, got out into the townships, and I saw the people that needed education and certain kinds of opportunities the most. But you give that person the opportunity, they don't know what to do with it. And that is the truth. And I've come out into this, back into this environment, and please support me if you can. If I'm wrong, just shoot me down. But you have entrepreneurs who are trying to feel their way through a business, but they don't know how to be a CEO. They don't know what that means. There's a skill set that is required to growing a business that we don't know. And so you pour some of these things into the crucible, and suddenly we're in a bit of a no man's land. And so flags, there are some concerns for me, particularly around skills.
You've touched on skills, and Kumaran, you've spoken just on the ability to be resilient, the ability to maneuver your business as times change as well. So, which actually brings me to Emmanuel. If you can tell us in a nutshell, what does Black Umbrellas offer SMEs?
Essentially what Gareth was talking about, that skills deficit that entrepreneurs, especially black ones, have, that Black Umbrellas tries to close that gap to ensure that at least over the 3 years that they're in an incubation program, that by the time they graduate out of the program, that skills deficit is gone. They have more confidence in themselves. They understand business fundamentally. And then they can go out there and become those CEOs that we all want them to be for the future, so that they create those businesses that will grow the future. So fundamentally, that's what Black Umbrellas is about. That's what we do through, obviously, the things we do within our three-year incubation program that we work with the SMEs. The fundamental issue is we want to ensure that we build sustainable black businesses that have the potential to have a great impact to grow and become the future big businesses that we need in the country.
May I say quickly what I love about Umbrellas? just to compliment, it's Kim. It was in your introduction where you said we've worked with 50 businesses since 2017. Some people may say 50 businesses—that's nothing.
That's Next Gen Academy.
Next Gen Academy. But people might say 50 businesses, and people may expect that Umbrellas has worked with thousands upon thousands. But that's not how it works. You take one, you pull them through to 100 million rand revenue, and you've done some real good in the country. You throw people into a classroom environment and say, this is entrepreneurship, and that does nothing. Anyway, sorry. So what I love about what you guys do is you really do take people from here to here, and it's, anyway, I'm sorry. Mm. I couldn't help myself.
That's true, because for us, it's, yes, look, as a country, we want to have maximum impact. We do. But at the same time, quality trans quantity. And we try and manage that as much as possible within our program. That's why all the potential entrepreneurs that come and want to join the program, only 5% actually get accepted into the program. Because we want to ensure that we bring in the right type of businesses with the right type of jockeys running those businesses with the higher probability of success over the 3 years. And yes, we don't always get it right, but we believe that we get it right most times than not. And just from a statistical perspective, just to show you the type of growth that what Gareth was talking about in terms of the type of businesses we worked with. In about 2014, the best performing business between Black Umbrellas was turning over about 7 million rand per annum. In 2018, the best performing business in Black Umbrellas turned over 152 million per annum. So you can see, and over the years we've grown, the average number of jobs created by the businesses in our program has grown from, I think 2016, 2017 was about 7 businesses. Last year it was 9 businesses on average. So for us, it's starting to really paint an amazing picture. Even the type of businesses that we work with, because we see that right now, I think 2018, businesses are with a turnover of 0 to 199,999. Listen carefully. I need to, yeah, I think it's grown.
Latest.
So basically on a pyramid, businesses from 0 turnover to almost 1 million. 2018, January, there was 80%. This year, 64%. So more of our businesses are graduating up the pyramid. 1 million to 5 million, 2018, 15%. This year, 26%. Between 5 and 50 million turnover, 4% in 2018, 9% in 2019. And obviously, the top tier, the QSCs, about 50 million, it stayed stagnant at about 1%, which is fine. But what we're trying to show is that the impact that we're looking for is actually translating in those businesses growing and growing and growing into the future. And that's what we want to continue to do.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Damiso, what do you think about the availability of funding being a burning platform that's affecting SMEs?
The big F word, right? Mm. Specifically for entrepreneurs. I would locate that specific question in the context of how the South African economy has evolved. In the 70s, 80s, the South African economy, the top four biggest contributing sectors to the economy was agriculture, mining, manufacturing, and government services. Fast forward to 2019, the biggest industry industry that contributes to our economy is financial services and business services, Manda. So you are chowing money, Chief.
Manda, shall we get another chair?
Yeah, but
sign the pledge card.
So that's the biggest. That's the biggest industry that's contributing to our economy. And with that kind of industry, you need more sophisticated skills to operate in that kind of industry. Then you have, on the flip side, a context where you have a population looks. Comparing South Africa with other countries across the continent, our literacy rates are quite high. Of course, recently we have recent challenges with the lack of sufficient availability of electricity. That's also compounded by a new phenomenon, not only in South Africa but across the globe, referred to as over-financialization of economies, where a lot of the time when revenues or returns are generated by businesses and deposited into banks, banks don't necessarily translate that into issuing out of new loans to business people and mortgages and. It's rather easier, and one is able to estimate better when reinvesting back those returns into financial assets. So that creates a shortage with respect to the risk that credit committees are willing to take with regards to SMMEs. But it also creates an instance where a lot of businesses and entrepreneurs look to VC funding, look to development finance institutions, and so on and so forth. And having done work for a few clients with regards to capital raising for development finance institutions, I think, Kumaran, you will advise with regards to the VC space and so on and so forth. There's a particular challenge with development finance institutions as it pertains to, for instance, fourth industrial type businesses, where, for instance, individuals who adjudicate a particular financing requirement for a tech business that has integrated machine learning and artificial intelligence to address a particular social need in South Africa, given the number of social challenges that we have, there's a challenge in terms of capacity and adjudicating that particular application. And you find that a lot of brilliant businesses, and particularly young people in the township who are exposed or more inclined towards technology, who are starting all these different kind of apps that do this, that, and the other, but you find that in terms of the aptitude to really having an understanding as to how this particular business model can work and what kind of financing requirements this particular innovation needs, development finance products don't speak to that kind of situation. An example would be I have a particular app that, does whatever it does. and you propose it to particular development finance institutions, and of course they would say, look, to ensure that the financing that we give will give us a bank for our buck, we need at least 6 months worth of financials and need to measure some way of measuring that the return that would be derived, or whether or not you'd be able to pay our interests on the financing that we give you. But for a tech business, all that you do really, you pilot your project. And primarily one of the indicators that you use, you look at traction, whether people willingly are taking up participation in your particular platform, but you're not necessarily generating revenues. And there are different instances because there are different products and innovation that people innovate with, and it makes it more complex in adjudicating finance applications to allocate funding to specific projects and businesses. And so I think there's an area, and perhaps we will get into that later on, around, and of course the Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution was pronounced yesterday or the day before. How do we deal with that particular capacity challenge so that we don't disadvantage brilliant ideas? And I've seen numerous brilliant ideas from South African entrepreneurs. I think South Africa is a brilliant country. But then this question of finance, how do we make it fluid and adaptable enough to speak to some of the brilliant business projects that are coming out at grassroots level?
Thank you. Thank you, Dumiso. So obviously, Kumaran, you're next. What do you think is the most effective funding model that works in our economy?
There's no one-size-fits-all. You know, when people say that there's not enough available funding, that's nonsense. There's more than enough available funding. The reasons, and I'm going to get to answer the question, but I think the context first is important. The one is that entrepreneurs, SMEs are not researching the universe of funding institutions that are out there. This, I haven't counted, but I'm pretty confident there's more than 100 funding institutions, whether you talk banks, equity funds, VCs, ESD funds, DFIs, alternative funders like ourselves. There's a lot.
In South Africa. Because, I mean, we live in a global economy.
Yeah,
as well,
but this is also an issue around the world. There was a study in UK recently where they asked SMEs their sense of awareness of alternative funders outside of their primary bank. And only 44% was aware of, this is UK, of alternative funders outside of their primary bank. So it's not only a South African thing, but I think it's maybe a bit worse here. It feels because this is the market we're in. So that's the first thing, not researching the universe of funders. Second is understanding the fit between what you need as an SME versus what the different funders are out there. And I think SMEs are self-inflicting the frustration on themselves when you're approaching the wrong funder for the wrong thing. I'll give you an aggravated example. If you're requiring early stage or VC funding and you're approaching the land bank as an example for something unrelated to farming. I know it's a ridiculous example, but I'm trying to prove my point. Or you're at a startup phase and you're approaching a DFI or even a bank, that you shouldn't be approaching any kind of formalized funder at all. So the second one is not understanding the fit on who to approach. Obviously, you're going to be despondent if you're talking to 20, 30 of them and you feel there's no funding available. But the problem is that second one. The third issue is that, and this is the biggest thing we find, biggest, is that the SME is not funder ready. Right. In other words, you apply for funding and a funder says, OK, we need these five things. And then they don't have the five things and maybe have one and take 2 months to get those five things ready. That's almost like going to the airport to book a flight. You don't have your ID book and a credit card to pay for it. So that's the third one. The fourth one, I would say, it's acknowledging the stage of your business. If you're at startup, formalized funders don't do startup funding. Even VCs don't do startup funding. You need to get angel investors. Angel investors, whether it's family or friends. So it's approaching the, not acknowledging the stage of your business where you are. And so that's a context about availability of funding. What's the one that works well in our context is what we've seen in since 2016, in the last 2.5 years, we've experienced a big uptick in the amount of black African-owned entrepreneurs that we are funding and are being acquired. And so this is not a color thing, but I'm just showing you the part that what works. And we think that it's this codes where they push the preferential procurement and whatever that's resulted in an uptick. And this is the point I'm building to, is the coordination with the corporate supply chain. That's what has the potential to work. And I'm not talking about the grants and ESD thing. I'm just talking about if the SME, like if they come out of black umbrellas, they're then ready to get into a corporate supply chain and they have something there. There's a triangulation between, okay, they've come out of some kind of process, there is a contract or a project, and then there's a funder de-risks a funder a little bit. So, but it's not well coordinated. That's the sadness. It's not, and I think there's an opportunity to coordinate that a bit better. So what I mean is that in a corporate, the ESD side will put the entrepreneurs through black umbrellas. They would come out and they have a certain set of KPIs as that corporate unit, that ESD unit. But the procurement has a different KPI. And that is to pay them in 90 days or give us supplies of this. And these two sometimes are conflicting. So there needs to be a better coordination. But I think that has an ability, we can accelerate funding there because funders like ourselves, we can de-risk a lot. And it allows them to increase their turnover and their contracts and projects within this corporate supply chain. That's one thing I would like to see happen a bit more.
Is there a deal size that you are seeing happen more and more often?
Our average deal size ourselves, first loan is about 4 million. Average facility now is about 8 million. Mm. So these are, because, and I would imagine in a corporate, they put a lot of effort by getting this, they're not going to go and give someone this a 500,000 rand contract. That whole kind of effort is a headache. So they want to have an excuse or legitimate thing to give someone something a little bit more sizable as a start. But now imagine you go through that trouble, you give them the contract, and then the SME after 3 months still hasn't got the funding. Now you have to withdraw that contract and give it to the next guy. So they are wanting to give a first stage a little bit of a larger one. We're seeing, you know, contracts in the region of 10, 15 million and as starting, and then they need this kind of 4, 5 million and funding to unlock that on a revolving basis. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Kamaran. Emmanuel, I've got a question for you with your power milestones in mind, the Black Umbrellas power milestones. What makes the Black Umbrellas program different and makes them ready for these kind of situations that they might face, this kind of environment? What is it about Black Umbrellas?
Yeah, I think I touched on it a little earlier, but again, for us, the focus is on impact. We want to see these businesses have a great impact in terms of job creation, wealth creation as well, and adding positive to the fiscus over the long term, and at the same time make sure that the success rate of small black businesses is doubled in the country. So that's very, very important for us. And that's why even our selection process is so rigorous, to ensure that we have the right type of businesses in the program, because obviously we clearly don't accept everyone. Only 5% of our businesses we deal with come through the program, and we want to ensure that those businesses grow. And we've seen actually amazing results from those businesses. I think a couple of them are sitting in this room this morning to show from where they started and where they are now as businesses. So it's very important for us to, as a program, to be able to measure success and to be able to define what success looks like as well, because we believe that that's how a program such as ours or similar is going to show real impact and value add for the SMEs and for the partners, the donors, stakeholders, and everybody we work with. So it's very, very important. And we've seen in the space that we're in that there's a lot of programs. There's a lot of programs. There's a lot of incubators, accelerators claiming to do the work that we do, but with no discernible results to show for it. And for us, that's a big issue. Yesterday, I was having a meeting with a group of guys from the African Development Bank. The African Development Bank has seen the risk, the political risk that sits with the continent, where we have a young population, not enough jobs, and therefore they're trying to drive entrepreneurship as their key to unlock those jobs and economic growth in the continent, where they want to partner with organizations such as ours and others to create this online platform where we share knowledge and at the same time have opportunity to get funding so that we continue to grow our programs to ensure that political risk that's there, if nothing changes and the young people revolt, they want that to go away. So it's important that as programs like ours, we start to show the results and show the impact so that we can start to show that we're turning the tide and making sure that young people get employed, entrepreneurs get opportunities that they need to grow their businesses. So it's really, really critical. Otherwise, we are going to find ourselves in a lot of deep trouble, I think.
Okay. Gareth, you look like you have a comment.
Question. I'm interested to know what you feel the time frame on deep trouble is. Because it's an important question. I mean, we're sitting in a pot that feels like it's beginning to boil. Are we frogs? that's my question.
Yeah.
I think I feel like
that. Look, we've
So, well, maybe we should tell them the.
Yeah. How do you? What's the best way to boil a frog? Slowly. You don't put it in a boiling pot. You put it in a cold pot and you turn it heat slowly, and it kind of gets used to it and doesn't.
Yeah. Thank you, Kumar.
So I think, we've been in a very difficult situation the past decade or so. And I think we really need to tread carefully because we've... generally, as a country, we need to really tread carefully because, like you say, we are in a very difficult situation where the economy is not growing at all. Unemployment is skyrocketing. Young people are struggling to find jobs. And crime rates escalating again. Clearly, you can see some of us have experienced it, some of my colleagues have experienced it like recently, you know. So it's not a myth that it happens out there, it happens to all of us. And I don't know what the time frame is, but it's clear that if nothing changes in the next number of years, we really might find ourselves in trouble because these things just happen. People just wake up one day and fed up. And things start happening. I don't think the people sit there and say there's a timetable, this is going to do this. No, people just wake up one day and it's too much and things start to happen. But I think the signs are there. And I just hope that the new dispensation, the new government that's coming after the elections takes all of that into account and things will start to change. But I also believe that they will change. Things are going to change. It will take a bit of time, but they are going to change because I don't think any of us in this room will want things to deteriorate and get worse than they are right now.
You need them to get a bit worse.
Because, I'm interrupting. Change only, you know, people, we change when there's self-gain or whatever, or there's pain. And most of the time, when you need big, seismic kind of change, it's mostly because of pain. And, you know, in 89 with that Tiananmen Square in China and whatever it is, yeah, you've got that mixture. So there is hope because you've got that mixture between a government that's communist and they've lifted a lot of people out with the economy doing the way it is, right? And, but they had to see the warning signs, things had to get worse for it to happen. So sometimes you need a burning platform, literally and figuratively.
I think we have.
And,
We
shouldn't be scared if it gets worse because, in my view, that's the only way it can
get
better when the horror is there.
Now that we've spoken about the economy, about finances, about supporting businesses, what role do you think mentorship plays?
I think the context to my comments were given earlier in the challenge to all of us about what we think we know about business and about entrepreneurship and about... And I'll say it this way. I think 90%, and that's just a made-up figure, but I could probably lean on it in some form or fashion, of the so-called entrepreneurs in South Africa are just freelancers. We're not entrepreneurs. An entrepreneur has a very specific way of looking at a situation and a set of elements and guiding those elements into building something or creating something that creates value. And above an entrepreneur, maybe some form of business manager or a management style like a CEO would have to use to return shareholder value and so on. But then beneath that, we've got freelancers, which are paycheck to paycheck style entrepreneurs. We take that title. And really, what is that person there to do? They're there to deliver value themselves. And so if you're doing the work yourself, I would challenge you and say you're probably not an entrepreneur, although it's a nice title to perhaps have. To your question around mentorship, in each of these stages, and it it goes back to this understanding of your business and where your business is also in its life cycle, is a necessity to have some form of guidance or insight, because we don't know it all. And so I'd rather pose the question to you right now: if you were able to have a mentor that was going to guide you with that problem that you're thinking of right now, would you take it? And there's the answer. I don't think I need to say anything else. The nodding heads, the twinkle in the eye, that says enough. Can I almost redirect a question a little bit?
Mm.
How important is mentoring to the people that you fund?
Very important, because an entrepreneur, as their business grows, the first barrier to scaling is leadership, which is themselves and the team. There's a book called Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, and it talks about the three barriers to growth. That's the first one. So, and we interview the jockeys because we're assessing them. So often you have to see the ability for the person to have a self-awareness and to learn and to get external knowledge and to be coachable. It's critical. Okay. If we don't see that coachability, we think, no, it's a problem. We don't fund them.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, so we've spoken a little bit about the fourth industrial revolution and the way technology is changing and, you know, where South Africa needs to catch up or not, or entrepreneurs need to catch up. Let's fast forward 10 years from now. Let's be as controversial as we can. Where do we see an entrepreneurial landscape 10 years from now? And I don't expect you all to have crystal balls, but just with the way that things are going and us having to catch up and speaking about resilience and skills and funding and the politics.
I still think we'll be getting the basics right. There's nothing wrong with that. Maybe some other countries will have, to be focused on that level of innovation requires the basic things to already be in order. It requires a stable foundational economy in all aspects, because all the sectors have to be humming, and then you can start doing innovative things like the fourth industrial revolution and coalescing and things coming together. And that's what's required, but I don't think we'll be there yet. There will be pockets here and there, but maybe some other nations may have that in a bigger context. There'll be a lot more focus on there. We are seeing people, our funding request is for weird, next level 3D type machines and all those things. So our country is going in the right direction, but it's not enough. And I would like us to see that we're still getting the basics right in all the sectors by then. And that's where employment and the stability will come in.
Okay. Thank you, Kamaran. What I'd like to do now is some Q&A. I'm just going to get a roving mic.
While the mic's coming up, may I make a comment?
Yes,
quickly?
Absolutely.
So I was looking at some research and information the other day where they spoke about in previous generations and decades and you needed EQ and IQ to come together, and you could probably build something fairly decent, whether it's a career or a business. This new approach is DQ, digital quotient, some kind of digital understanding. I don't know about you, but I'm not very smart, and I'm not a data scientist, and I'm not an AI specialist. And so is anyone here an AI specialist? Can you put your hands up and say, I am an AI specialist, I know where it's going to go? The reason I ask that question is because what happens is we have this question come up quite a lot in different platforms and areas, and the people that are commenting aren't the AI specialists. I can't answer that question.
It's very interesting if you look at all the four revolutions and how they've taken place and what that means, because the previous three spoke predominantly about technological advancement. But this one is a bit different because it's sort of now blurring the lines between humans and technology and the robots and so forth. And if you read the book by the founder of WEF, who wrote about this in 2016, that this revolution is different in that it's not about technological advancement, but it's sort of trying to bridge inequality amongst people. But the funny thing is that then I saw an article on CNBC that spoke the opposite, where it says in the past 40 years, 80% of the 40 top innovations that have taken place, 80% of those were driven by billionaires. So 80% of the best innovations in the past 40 years were driven by billionaires. That means 1% of the population that already controls 47% of the world's money are the ones that are driving the fourth industrial revolution. The change that we've seen, so what more in terms of inequality is going to happen in the future? Because they talk about this economy going forward becoming a more a winner-takes-all type economy. Then let's share, let's give, let's bring others up with us. So how is that going to happen? How is the fourth industrial revolution going to help to bridge inequality when actually the people with the money are the ones that are driving it and going to drive it even more going forward? Now, talking about Elon Musk of this world, say, you know, a few individuals controlling AI, what does it mean for everyone in the future? So it's just something to think about and to ponder, because it's meant for one thing, but it's actually doing a different thing because of lack of access for others, lack of funds and so forth. And from a South African perspective, an SME perspective, it scares me, because my view is that SMEs are already behind other SMEs in other countries. And my colleague Nyasha went to a conference in Morocco last year where what she saw started comparing to what she sees here back in SA in terms of SMEs and innovation and so forth. And she said the things they do there, half our SMEs here don't even think about it, don't do. They do breakthrough stuff, yes, to solve day-to-day problems, but the way they do it, their thinking, their actions are different from our SMEs. Because here in SA, you'll still find an SME saying running an IT company that wants to install computers. In 2019, you want to install computers, boxes. Who does that in 2019? Imagine what will happen in the next 10 years with the fourth industrial revolution. If our SMEs, because we're playing a catch-up game, and I feel like we're getting left even more behind than others right now.
Behind now, we need the questions.
Yeah.
Thank you, Emmanuel, for that very passionate response.
It's so good to hear.
The floor is open, and Siyapay, over to
you. I've got a quick comment on the fourth industrial revolution before I ask my question. So I attended a conference, a media conference, hosted by Bloomberg in Zambia last year, and I came out of there feeling a lot more comfortable about that fourth industrial revolution that everybody's speaking about, and kind of how, you know, the experts in the room, and these were global experts doing all sorts of technology, medical technology, et cetera, said that the population of the world will actually determine the pace of this revolution. And Emmanuel just made a comment about a lot of the innovations of the past decade being led by, you know, some of the wealthiest in the world. And because of that, what these experts were saying is that this fourth industrial revolution actually has a lot of prejudices built into it. So, you know, we had doctors in the room, we had experts who were saying, because of who designs some of these technologies, you know, we had a doctor in the room that was describing a facial recognition tool that was rolled out somewhere in Europe. And he was saying that the guys that created it were all Caucasian. And as a result, the first time it was rolled out and it came across a black person, because of the dimensions of our faces and certain body parts, it actually thought that it was talking to a monkey, like really. And so he was saying immediately in his hospital, this technology actually couldn't work. It had to be sent back, and there's a lot more work that needs to go into it. So I think the comfort that that gave me is that, you know, we all feel like the bullet train has left us, but I honestly think that it has probably left a big chunk of the world's population behind, and there's a lot more work that's going to need to happen in order to catch it up. That's my piece.
Thank you, sir.
The question I wanted to ask is different. You spoke a little bit about mentorship, and I want to speak about networks, and my question is for Emmanuel and and kind of the work that you do at Black Umbrellas. So I spend 80% of my time at BU building networks. That's what I do. I meet people. I have coffees. I have lunches. I have meetings. I talk on the phone. And that is probably kind of the biggest realization when I took over the role of CEO, is that the work itself, the strategy on paper, stood no chance, no matter how brilliant it was, if I didn't have the base of supportive networks. And what I'm realizing now is even when we have an idea that's only about 20% great, when we have broad and deep networks, it can take it so much further. So the challenge and the question I'm posing to, you know, maybe Emmanuel, but everyone on the panel is, I continue to see entrepreneurs or SMEs or whatever you'd like to call them, who have done well, but who haven't built the right type of networks. And I believe that that introduces a level of stagnation into their businesses. So your business on its own merits, on kind of the brilliance of it, will only take you to a certain place. You know, if you're looking for kind of the dynamic, if we look at the South African context and we look at the Adrian Gores of the world, I think part of his success, you know, it's not just the kind of the magic of the program that was developed, but that really early on, he built some really huge networks. Probably some that he was a little bit ahead of the time when he started and kind of forced him to think about the business he was building, and not just to build a South African business, but kind of a global business, and continues to challenge him to think about new age things and to make it huge. And how do we infuse that into the entrepreneurs in our country to ensure that as their businesses are growing, so are their networks and the dynamism of their networks that can hopefully, you know, introduce them to new markets and new opportunities. Thanks.
Thank you, Siope. Before the panel answers, there's pen and paper there if you want to write down the questions and just to get. Okay?
Yes, I think it's a very critical question, Siope, because we've seen sometimes in the work that we do, unfortunately, it creates dependencies sometimes, and that's the challenge, and that's what we've been trying to eradicate, because we've seen a number of our businesses that we work with do well while they're in the program and grow to a certain level. And then by the time they leave the program, this sort of, like Sabi says, they stagnate, because somehow, for whatever reason, they sort of placed black umbrellas as their, I don't know what to call it, basically a platform that helps them to go get the networks, instead of owning that part for themselves and saying, I want to ensure that I have solid networks for myself as an entrepreneur, as a business, so that even after I've left the program, I'm able to tap onto those networks and work them and grow them and make sure that my business continues to grow and flourish. And that's where the challenge is. And we had a chat earlier this year. We were lucky to have Robbie Brosen, the founder of Nando's, come and speak to us at our management stress session this year. And he spoke about networks as well and how they grew Nando's through the networks, the people that they knew to help them grow that business, and them driving those networks rather than depending on someone else to drive those networks for them and being open to it. And I think for me, that's the most critical part, especially with what you had said also, Gareth, about the difference between entrepreneurs and others who call themselves entrepreneurs, but they're not necessarily entrepreneurs, because as an entrepreneur, you have to be open to going and talking to people and building solid networks, networks that are mutually beneficial. Because sometimes it feels like when you deal, when you're trying to create networks, it's only one-sided. Because it's what can I get from this person, rather than how do I build a meaningful relationship that in the long term will benefit them, but will also benefit me as well. I think maybe that's how entrepreneurs need to start looking at it. So I don't know what other views are.
From my side, a network is an entrepreneur's biggest asset, yep. Because most entrepreneurs start off with sweet nothing. And the first funding, if you happen to have a bit on your own or whatever, but if you don't, it's coming from an angel funder or family, friends, and fools. The start of what we're doing is always a network. And for me, if I had to lose everything, as long as I had my phone with the 6,000 contacts on it, because you're always disciplined about maintaining the contact, yep. I feel you can survive anyway. The two things is important with networking. One is to acknowledge the latent leverage power of it. When we talk about leverage, one is to leverage finance, but the more important thing is to leverage your network, and here's the kicker, your network's network. So that's what wins for me, is my network's network. So I may know you, but if I see you on LinkedIn or something, you know someone else, and I need to get to that person, that's in your network, right? That's very powerful. So the first thing is to acknowledge this power of it. You know, it's intangible, so we don't think it's powerful, but it is. I swear to you, it is. The second is to develop the skill and the kind of art around going about doing that.
Yep.
The first thing is, if most of us are introverted, then you say, I'm not good at it. And as soon as you say you're not good at it, then you're not good at it. Mm. And so is to take away that defeatist language and go and get comfortable speaking. I came from a deeply introverted background, still slightly, and I went to Toastmasters years ago, and to learn to speak and do all those types of things. That gave me a little bit of comfort. And so develop the skills. You know, you buy a book on networking, figure that out. It's surprising, sometimes I go to an event, someone comes and say, can I have your card? But they don't introduce themselves. Who am I? Here's my card. This is what I want to talk to you about and whatever. So two things. Acknowledge that it is critical. It's an untapped asset. And second, develop the skills. Don't defeat yourself.
I think as well that this point of networking, it's been proven. It's an area of fascination that I've always had around the role of human capital and people in the growth of businesses. And there are two specific scholars in the U.S. at Harvard University that had a similar studies, or they're actually experts in these particular areas. On the one side, it's a professor called Ricardo, and he was looking at it at the level of an economy. Which economies become more prosperous based on what factors? And one of the things that his research suggests is that the more complex an economy is, the more prosperous it is likely to become. But that complexity is informed by how they manage topical issues in the world today, migration, attracting of high-skilled individuals in a particular economy, and their role that they play. You look at the U.S., for example. The U.S. is really built on the lives of and the hard work of migrants. You look at whether it be in sports, basketball. Some of the tallest people are from Africa, but the African Americans in the U.S. You have some of the top academics in the U.S. are not U.S. citizens; they're from around the world. So you look at this basket of diversity in one country, and this diversity and the networks that have been built as a consequence of this collective and what they're able to produce. The second point he mentioned is one of the key attributes of diversity in the collective is the issue of know-how. So if we all are plumbers in this room, we don't add value whatsoever except knowing how to plumb. Mm-hmm. But if we have a plumber, we have an electrician, we have a finance guy, and there's much more we can do when we have these diverse skill sets. But he says the challenge with this particular issue is that know-how does not move in mass. The same way that the people that are not in this room right now won't have access to the exchanges and the insights that we're sharing here today, they won't have access to this know-how. And he was looking at it at the level of individuals, that know-how moves at the level of individuals. But that comes with building networks, building connections over a sustained period of time. That's the one scholar. The other scholar looks at it at the level of, over the past 1,500 years, what have been some of the key contributors to the growth and prosperity of some of the largest economies in the world? And he looked at it from portfolio flows, which is financial markets. He looked at it from data flows. He looked at it from a question of migration. And there's a fourth factor in that particular matrix. And all of the top-performing countries, the migration of people was a leading factor towards their prosperity. Mm-hmm. And of data as well, which is now referred to as soft infrastructure today. So the role of networks and relationships and connections and how information moves between people becomes an important factor in terms of a business person or entrepreneur being able to grow their business to the next level. Because really, I guess a business cannot grow. It can only grow to the level at which the leadership capacity of that head is at. Mm. If that individual is not growing, then that business will always be a 9 if the leader is a 10. If it doesn't graduate to be a 12, it'll be 11. Really, so those are the two ideas I think that are relevant.
Thank you. I know the panel has lots to say, but I see there's more questions. So if you just raise your hand, we've got a roving mic here, Siviwe. So we'll take a question from Danica and then Deshun, and then we'll... Is there a third question anywhere? Great, got your hand up. So we'll take three questions and then answer them. That's okay with the panel. Pen and paper, guys, if you need it.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Danica. So, question. I don't know if it's controversial. I was kind of challenged. So I consider myself very proudly part of the Fees Must Fall generation. And I believe that there is a lot of energy in that movement, and I believe that part of that movement can be challenged into entrepreneurship. And when Gareth asked the question earlier on, well, posed the question, what does entrepreneurship mean? I asked myself and I thought to myself, what does it mean to me? And I'll be honest, to me, it's scary. There's a lot of risk involved in entrepreneurship. And I thought about my generation and what it means, you know, risk. And I thought, well, my generation is brave, is bold, you know, fees must fall. We've done a lot. I'll pose a question to all of you. How do you think we can take this fierce generation of people who are loud and proud and doing things about the world and take that boldness and take into consideration that being an entrepreneur does come with risk and it is scary? And how do we take that and make it optimistic and consistently optimistic? You also spoke about being optimistic and being resilient. How do we maintain that, and how do we be leaders as entrepreneurs and, you know, mentors and consistently motivate people and get them through the hard times? How do we do that?
Dashan?
Oh, okay.
You've got a mic.
I've got quite a lot of questions, but I'm going to start with my own personal experience. My business is disrupting the performance management industry. We are completely changing the way performance management is done because it's 20th century stuff. Nobody likes it, you know, and there are better ways now with digital transformation happening the way it does. One of my major frustrations as an entrepreneur here is when I go to Europe, people are open to new ideas. They invite you in. They want to spend time and explore what you have to offer. My problem is I'm not in Europe. It's not my environment. My environment is here. I get to go there because of the work I do. But when I'm here, I get all these closed doors, and there's just an incredibly negative attitude towards entrepreneurs who are innovative here and trying to drive their businesses out of here. And everyone wants to acknowledge if you've got an American product, a European product, or something that was designed there and brought in. But our product is designed here, and Europe is interested, but South Africa isn't. I know we can't do anything about people's attitudes, but how do we change the narrative around the excellence that actually comes out of here, the innovation that's already existing, the digital platforms that can already be used to transform business and society? Who are those people with the authority to speak clearly about the quality of innovation that's coming out of South Africa? Because what I will be forced to do is move to Europe, because I've experienced there the openness, the you know, their willingness to explore. And I'm talking about big organizations like Royal Philips and Munich Re and Daimler. But when I knock on the doors here, I'd rather not mention any of the businesses here. You get nothing but this incredible brick wall of, oh, you created the product, it can't be any good. They don't say that, but you know that's kind of the attitude that comes with it. And so I have a really big frustration around that. I've got a lot of other frustrations, but I'll stop there. Any opinions on that? I mean, what do we do to change the way South Africans look at the quality and excellence that's already existing here out of the small business network?
Thank you, Dashan. And then we've got one question over here, please. Mangaliso, we'll come to you straight after. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Tabuho, and you said one question, so now I have to cut it down because I have four. But I really appreciate the two ladies that have just gone before me, because actually three, because I think their questions somehow, in a way, answer each other. Gareth, earlier on, I really remember what you said. You said that we need to figure out between entrepreneurs and CEOs. And to Danica's point, that becomes really unfair because I think in South Africa the push is for really to get entrepreneurs to solve our macro problems. So to create all the jobs that we need to go to SMEs and lower levels of the economy. But the truth is some of us keep ourselves employed, I mean the gig economy, we keep ourselves employed by being entrepreneurs. So I'm not really interested in being a CEO. I just want to be an entrepreneur that has a product and I want to get that to someone else. I don't want to be Adrian Goh because he's great at what he does, but he has to manage 1,000 Discovery employees. And we then need to understand that we're not just training one level of entrepreneur. It's we're doing it at very many different instances. And Danica's generation, which I think, I hope I'm not far from them, but not everyone wants to be Bill Gates. And not everyone wants to be, you know, the chairman of a huge corporation. And we need to stop glamorizing entrepreneurship by making it the really big guys that matter. Because a person who employs himself has taken one person out of employment, out of unemployment. And that's important. We really need to get that. But the CEO before also spoke about networks, and I was hoping she was going to go where I was praying she was going, but she did not. She mentioned it in terms of the entrepreneur and making networks for yourself. But in the incubation space, in the BDSP space, what we find is there's not a lot of collaboration or collation of skills. So everybody's training, but training in silos. Everybody is doing something great for the entrepreneur, but we're also not getting those lessons in the ecosystem to make sure that we're refining. I mean, the CEO of Black Umbrella said earlier on that there's no impact in other areas, you know? My question is, and my challenge is, what is it that Black Umbrellas is doing to bring up everybody else? We need everybody else in the same space, but how are we sharing those lessons and making sure that everybody can produce the kind of results that you are?
Panel, there's one more question. Are you okay, Phil? Okay, one more. Thanks, Mangaliswa.
Thank you very much. Ladies have summed up most of my concerns. It's really around the issue of where we come from as a country. I don't want to be political as such, but I feel it's very unfair for someone to sit in one corner and say, we're schizophrenic. Not to attack anybody or anything like that, but it's more a case of we trying to develop black business. Where do these black businesses come from? They're individuals at the end of the day. They were brought up in some severe situations. They start at -5 when the competitors start at 5. I wouldn't go down the route of some people are privileged or all of that. Just not, I don't want to be political. But we need not forget where we come from. Because we come with baggage. We're trying to rise above situations that are hard. And yet people will come and say, yeah, no, we're schizophrenic. Yeah, I am schizophrenic. Because I had experienced a lot of injustices. But I need to rise above that. So for me to rise above that, BU will come and say, hey, let's heal your hurt and give you a platform where you can start. Yes, they call us entrepreneurs. So what? So we can feel good about ourselves? I look at myself in the mirror and I say, hey, you know what? I'm looking forward to the day. I'm this guy who's going to change the world. I don't have a word to call myself. I can only call myself an entrepreneur. I cannot say I'm a freelancer. I don't want to look down at myself. Why should I look down at myself? I can't. So when you ask, why is it that the wall you face every day, you ask for whatever, it's the attitude that you have to say that pessimist is the it. There's a level of pessimism that's going around, and it's not good.
Thank you. Okay, panel, we've had a bit to ponder. If anybody would like to take a stab at answering the questions.
Okay, I have one or two thoughts with regards to some of the comments and questions that have been put forward. Firstly, I'd like to start on the question of, just to backtrack slightly, South Africa's role in the fourth industrial revolution and our preparedness and the 10-year outlook. In my view, I think South Africa and Africa has an incredible opportunity ahead of it, primarily because, in my perspective, I think the innovators that will come out of the continent are more individuals who are social scientists than are technological people. This is because from the experiences that I've had with working with some guys who are doing some incredible innovations, whether it be in Silicon Cape or in different tech incubators, most of the ones that I've come across are not necessarily data scientists or whatever. This is actually an individual said, "Ish, what if we could do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 using this channel of technology to solve this particular problem?" Yeah, but I know a software developer. A friend of mine studied IT and programming. We can probably rope him. So you find this combination of teams that are solving a particular problem, but you find that the author of that particular concept is not necessarily a data scientist, but somebody who's about solving particular problems. I think that's on the one side. I think with respect to the question of the South African landscape not being as receptive to some transformative ideas and innovations and offerings that business people and entrepreneurs come up with, from my experiences and from the little research that I've been able to do thus far, is that, and this is just one of many, from what I've learned is that timing, particularly in our context, also becomes a significant deterrent or a stumbling block. An example would be high-definition televisions. High-definition televisions was an innovation from the 80s, but it only started picking up now once the supporting infrastructure that supports that particular platform or that device had been implemented to be able to support that kind of innovation. It's the same with electric cars. We're seeing small uptakes with electric cars because here and there, maybe in Melrose and you're finding electric car chargers, but only once there's a huge uptake or scaling of that, then we'll begin to see people become more comfortable with buying more electric cars. And I think it's the same with some of the ideas and the businesses that we try to establish in different contexts, that sometimes timing becomes a deterrent. Sometimes you find that something that might not work in South Africa in 2019 will boom in 2029 for whatever reasons. So that's just one learning that I had on that particular question. Danika's point on using the dynamism and energies of young people to drive South Africa to the next phase, I've seen the dynamism of young people and the ideas that they have. I think a lot of the time, sometimes it becomes a generational question, the issue of demographics and the median age in Africa being 20 years old and people who are leading are above 65, and it becomes that kind of question. And sometimes it becomes slightly a bit disrespectful when it comes from younger guys. But I think it becomes one of the issues that are serve as a bit of a hindrance in terms of being able to reach some level of change or transformation or implement some of the great ideas that young people come up with. And you'd find a few of us.
Can I just interrupt you quickly? Gareth, I know you've got to run. So I don't know if you want to quickly give us a closing remark.
Sure.
Sorry, everybody, Gareth's got a plane to catch, which is going to leave shortly without him. So if you want to just give us a remark, and then, Demisa, I rudely interrupted you. We'll come back to you. Yes. Apologies.
I'm sorry for taking your time. Let me do one or two very quick answers. So I think Danica, is that right? There's two sayings, and I like sayings because they hold a fair bit of truth in them, the good ones anyway. And the one is, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. So to your question around how do we convert this courage into something more, do more. But then in the position of doing more, arises a concern around confidence. And so I learned a definition of confidence many years ago that has served me for my entire career, and has probably allowed me to scratch beneath the surface of a couple of places and things, which has then propelled me forward. And the definition is, confidence is trust in processes that work. And it's a loaded definition, so if you pull apart each word, you'll see how you can develop confidence very quickly if you work through various processes, which includes a lot of failure, to get to a point where you have an entrepreneurial confidence or a networking confidence, so this works for anything. And so there's my answer to that question. I think that may dovetail a little bit with one or two of the other things that have been asked here. Dashin, I don't know. I don't know. I There's a...
So it's that thing of like just getting to the point of by when will the infrastructure support the electric car? And yeah, must one wait, or... So it for me, it's a real issue because I've been grinding away for years and years, for over a decade, testing here, testing there, testing it overseas and seeing how it works and bringing it back here and providing the data to show how it works. And just lots and lots of people, entrepreneurs, all sorts of people going through this program and attesting to its value. And so what you're basically saying to me is the market's not ready. You're going to have to wait until there's an infrastructure to adopt your electric car or go overseas. And if I do go overseas, I'm starting jobs there, but the jobs need to be created here. I don't know what to do. It's like...
Seth Godin, who's quite a remarkable thinker when it comes to certain kinds of businesses, and he's done a number of different things, and he speaks about going to where the yeses are. Yeah. And so that's all I have. I cannot tell you anything else. I'm sure you'll get something else from the panel. Yeah. So my answer to you is I don't know, but it's probably to go where the yeses are. And I realize that means...
Yeah.
Leaving something behind, but there's always opportunity cost, I think, in everything. There was a question around this thing around identity. I think if you are settled in your identity, then embrace it fully and then go with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
But the truth about it is any business exists to solve a human problem.
Yeah, I agree.
That's it. You can solve a human problem with 3 employees, with 200 employees, as long as you're doing something. The only issue is we're now glamorizing it to the point where people feel that if they can't call themselves a particular thing, then they can't be an entrepreneur. So there really isn't any pride and any point to that.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying. 2 days ago, I was with the CEO of a large property organization. That he's got him a trick. That's all he has, and billions flow through his business every year. And I can probably go through a whole list of different executives that don't have what we think that they have. To your point, just add value, and the more value you add, the greater your impact, the better off you're going to be. And then finally, my comment around schizophrenia. I want to clarify that, if I may, not to defend my position at all, but just to clarify, what I don't believe is that we as individuals are necessarily schizophrenic, but rather that our entire machine has to move and play different roles in different areas. So, for example, our government, when they're looking for foreign investment, say something very different to what is said when they are pandering for votes from the masses in South Africa. And so in that way, we absolutely are schizophrenic. Does that mean that we are impacted by that? Absolutely, yes. So there's a side of me that absolutely is schizophrenic. You know, ask my wife. But the opportunity that exists in that is that there's a strength that we can develop, a tenacity, something that we can build, which no other entrepreneur and or business person can. We live in such a complex environment, and that's exciting as it is, as much as it is scary. And so, in short, I'm very optimistic about South Africa. I'm bloody scared of AI, and I have to go and catch a flight.
Before we let Gareth go, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to thank him once more for his insights, for the invaluable time that he's spent here with us. Gareth, thank you very much. And then we'll continue very shortly. We are pressed for time. So, Gareth, we're going to let you go with an applause. Thank you so much. Thank you, yeah. And then, panelists, I'd like to hear your closing remarks based on answers to those questions, if we can have them briefly, please.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Do you want a ching chong cha? Yeah. Go for it,
Kumari. Mm-hmm. I want to answer that question specifically, and then I'll make a general comment. You know, on your question about the getting into the customers with your innovative type of thing. There's three things. One is a prophet is often not appreciated in their own land. You know, you heard of that saying. So that's one thing. Sometimes the clean eyes can kind of see something differently. Second, there is a thing for readiness and maturity. So maybe the South African market or the segments you're talking to are not yet ready and mature. It could be as simple and innocent as that. And then your other markets are ready and mature. There's nothing, you know, sinister about that second one. The third one is like what he said, go to where the yeses are. Normally, if you're talking to corporates, they want to cover the CYA, you know, cover your ass, safer decisions. Maybe they're anxious about their own kind of jobs and certain things. So you need a maverick. You need to approach the right mavericks inside there to try something innovative. So that, those are those comments on that. Generally, there's a general kind of comment. What that cool gentleman there was saying and yourself, I think there's a saying by this Larry Ellison, you know, he's a founder of Oracle, fifth or sixth largest or richest man in the world. And he said, when he talked about success, he says, I was fortunate. I was blessed with all the adversities required for success. And so it's a mindset. And for me, is that we've all walked in different shoes, our own shoes with different adversities. But that's a powerful thing. That's a jet fuel, I feel. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in this thing with the fees must fall or whatever, how do we do? My view, it's this world is a jungle. And so the entrepreneur is partly born, natured, and partly nurtured. He will or she will rise and do whatever they need to do. You don't need to over-nurture them. You just need the right support at the right kind of places. And so our adversity is a very powerful thing. Yes, it gives you a bit of rebelliousness. Yes, it's a bit of if them, I'll show them kind of thing. And it's the persistence to carry on when things don't work out. It's an attitudinal type of thing. So we should celebrate our adversity and use it as fuel, you know. I'm grateful for my adversities that I've had, because if I didn't have them, I wouldn't have taken these parts where I am now. That's an important thing. Black Umbrellas, we have a working alliance with them. And, you know, the thing that comes out, this is my final comment, when you come out of incubator, they're not meant to do everything for you. It's just a development, a mentorship, a certain stage in your life, and then you go. You can't hold on to them like a banquet, everything, or this permanent training wheels, right? And there's meant to be much to determine what a success if you come out of a Black Umbrellas or something like that. But the two immediate things that can be measured, besides the jobs and whatever, the two immediate things is, are you capacitated enough and confident enough to get a contract or project or revenue? And are you funder ready? And I can speak from our limited context, the entrepreneurs that we have funded and are starting to fund coming up, they are definitely funded already. Some of them.
Sadly, the recorder seemed to give up the ghost at that point. I'm as disappointed as you are, because I was eager to hear the answers and closing statements of my colleagues on stage. Did you hear anything you disagreed with? I'd love to hear from you. Please look me up on my website or social media and drop me a line or a voice note. And also, don't wait for the next podcast recording to come out. Come and join us at the next NextGen Masterclass as an audience member and have your say there too. My name is Gareth Armstrong, and I look forward to seeing you there.